Welcome to Radio Oldie, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. Hello and welcome to Radio Oldie with me, Harry Mount, editor of the Oldie, and I'm delighted to be talking to Merlin Holland, Oscar Wilde's only grandchild, who has just written an extremely moving book, After Oscar, The Legacy of a Scandal. Now, Merlin, I've just seen you in another very moving ceremony receive Oscar's British Reading Room card, and it seemed to me, you're talking to Rupert Everett, is it fair enough to say you quite like talking about your grandfather now?
I'm much easier with it than I used to be, I have to say that. It's a blessing and a curse in some ways. I've always described it a bit like the saints on the outside, on the facade of cathedrals. And I mean, this is purely an image rather than trying to compare myself to them in moral terms. But you sit in a niche with your back protected. And I felt for many years that I would never dreamed of doing it, but even if I had tried to be the grandson of Oscar Wilde, I think that the daggers in my back would have been, you know, multiple, as evidenced by other people who've tried to do much the same thing about their famous forebears. Yes, I'm much more comfortable talking about it than I used to be. But from, as I've put it in another simile, from the outside of the monkey cage, you know, rather than being on the inside, you know, what does he look like? He's Oscar Wilde's grandson. Having got the key to get on the outside, I can be with everybody else looking in, so to speak. And that has made me, yes, much more comfortable.
And your book is really quite extremely moving, and it's a lot of it is about how the tragic scandal of Oscar Wilde echoes through the century, right into your own lifetime. And there's a heartbreaking story about you walking down a street with a schoolboy friend aged about six. And you could tell us what happened there.
Well, he was the son of my godfather, a journalist, William Maud Jackson, and good, very good friend of my father. And we went to the same kindergarten together. And Simon and I were great mates. And we went out on school walks, and you know, at midday, as one did in those days. And I would put my arm through his or round his shoulder or something. And it was many years later that his mother said to me, "We were told that you and Simon couldn't go walking on the school crocodile together." And I said, "I don't actually remember it." And she said, "Well, it's absolutely true." And the school was worried that maybe if you were showing the same tendencies as your grandfather, it wouldn't be a good idea if you put your arm round Simon's shoulder. Absolutely ridiculous in today's terms. But I think it's, as I've tried to show in my book, the homophobia alive and well in the 1950s Britain was something which I think people have conveniently forgotten about. You know, the arrest of John Gielgud, Edward Montagu, Peter Wildblood, both of whom finished up in prison. You know, we weren't such a terribly tolerant society in those days.
And in fact, it reaches a sort of peak. There's a very good, almost tragicomic scene when your father, Vivian Holland, is trying to arrange a centenary plaque in Tite Street, and all sorts of people say, "Well, I'd love to, but I'm not actually around that day." And John Gielgud says yes, but
that he said yes at the end of 1953, and it was only ironically on Oscar's birthday, the 16th of October, that he was in court for cottaging, as it was called. And had to withdraw. And the number of people that they tried to get to unveil the plaque, I think it was something like 8 or 10 different people, all of whom, as you say, made various excuses. Well, I don't think I should be around, or I don't actually... If to do that, one really has to have some sort of sympathy for the person. And I don't think I have a great sort of sympathy for Oscar Wilde. And it endless. Eventually, it was done by Compton Mackenzie, who was a friend of my father's. But today, actors would be falling over themselves to unveil a plaque. The nice epilogue to that was that John Gielgud then did unveil a plaque on the back of the Haymarket Theatre in 1995 to celebrate the centenary of the first night of An Ideal Husband. And at the time, David Queensberry, the grandson of the infamous Marquis, or great-grandson, I can't quite remember, it's a complicated line, was there, and I was talking to David, and a Times journalist came up, all excited, and said, "This is the first time that the Queensberrys and the Hollands have been talking for 100 years. And I said, "No, David's father and mine were quite good mates." "Oh, pity," he said, there's no story in a friendship. I was very happy that John Gielgud could, in the end, unveil a plaque to Oscar Wilde, having played in so many of his plays.
Wonderful. And in your very wide-ranging book, it's also a sort of semi-biography of your father, who is Oscar Wilde's second son, who comes across as an extremely amiable, highly intelligent, but not too got down about it person. He survives the whole scandal in his aftermath extremely well. Is that fair enough?
I think so, yes. I mean, he sailed under false colours in the sense that the name was changed and he remained Holland for the rest of his life after the scandal. He was very ambivalent about it. I think he took a pride in his father's achievements. After he came back from the First World War, Robert Ross, who had been Oscar Wilde's great friend and probably his first homosexual lover, had taken charge of the literary estate and did it for nothing. I mean, he did it for love of his old friend and for the two boys, my father Vivian and Cyril. But after the First World War, my father had lost Robbie Ross, who died prematurely at the age of about 48, I think. He'd lost his brother in 1915 to a German sniper. He'd lost his first wife. And he came back to England and, as he said in his second volume of autobiography, it was a sort of repeat of what happened back in 1898 when his parents, well, he thought both parents had died. I came back to England and there was, as he said rather movingly, there was nobody for whom I was the most important person in the world. But he benefited from the royalties, and at that moment that he comes back to England, he said, "It's a terrible irony that I should be the only one now benefiting from Oscar's plays and his works." So there was one side of it which was the difficulty of having to be Oscar Wilde's son. And you can imagine, if he had kept the name, his mother hadn't changed the name, being Oscar Wilde's son until probably the second decade of the 20th century. As he said in a diary somewhere, it was always there, "Oh, look, there's Oscar Wilde's son, dig in the ribs, how interesting, I wonder what he's like." And so I think it was difficult for him, but in later years, he came to terms with it. I think that one of the big difficulties was when Oscar Wilde's letters were published in 1962, and it was done by Rupert Art Davis, great publisher, and he tried to persuade my father to include all of them, including those which were unequivocally homosexual in the latter years of Oscar's life. And it took a lot of persuading. Rupert worked on my father for 2 or 3 years to get him to agree to this, and he did in the end. Interestingly, when Cyril Connolly wrote a review of the book, he said, "And finally, Vivian Holland has to be commended for allowing the letters to be done uncensored." And I think that meant a lot to him, that the wheel had come full circle, I think, by then.
And you, I think, have thought about taking up the surname Wilde, is that right? But you've decided not to.
Yes. My father gave me the opportunity when I was 21. He thought, you know, this is the time. Merlin becomes of age and maybe he can take back the family name. And I think it was a sense almost that I was doing it by proxy for him. I think he would have liked to have done it, but simply couldn't bring himself to. And I considered it very briefly and just said, no, and I'm your son. I'm far more your son than my grandfather's grandson.
And it's useful for you, isn't it? You can put on your Oscar Wilde hat and remove it at will to a certain extent.
That's a very accurate way of putting it. Yeah, I suppose so. Yes, that's very true. Very true.
And to go back to the early days of your father, it's also full of heartbreak. There's a suggestion that he and your Uncle Cyril could have met Oscar in Paris after he gets out of prison. That is viable, isn't it? But they didn't know he was there.
No, that's absolutely right. I mean, I've conjectured this in my book, that the Jesuit priest who accompanied my father from Monaco, where he was being schooled, after his mother's death — his mother was then living in Italy, and Vivian then had no one to look after him in the holidays. So the guardian, who was living in England, had both boys. Cyril was sent back from Germany, and my father from Monaco. And certainly from Monaco, he would have had to pass through Paris, where his father was living at that time. Other people knew where Vivian was being schooled, friends of Oscar's. It's another of those awful what-if situations. I don't know whether Cyril probably wouldn't have had to go back through,
right,
through Paris. And later, much later in life, my father conjectures what would have happened if my father had written to me. I would certainly have replied. Cyril probably wouldn't. I would have looked after him. Cyril probably would have repudiated him. And I think that was the great difference between the two brothers. My father, I think, had much more feeling for Oscar. Cyril could never get over the whole question of what he called the stain on the family, the shame of his father having been sent to prison.
And so Cyril became more upstanding than was possible, joined up, and was died a heroic death on the Western Front.
Exactly. And I have put into the book the exchange of letters which they had in 1914, in the early months of 1914, because they didn't really get on terribly well together. Cyril disapproved of Vivian's slightly loose attitude towards life, not being good with money, not wanting to go into the civil service, wanting to try and make a living out of writing. And Cyril was this very upstanding, upright officer in the Royal Field Artillery. You can imagine that the elder brother disapproving of the younger brother's progress, if one can call it that, in life, which certainly wasn't what he, as Cyril, had planned for himself. And then they exchange letters, and it's a very moving exchange. My father put a little tiny bit of Cyril's letter into his first volume of autobiography in 1954, but I felt the time had come for these two brothers to express themselves openly and in print, how they felt about each other and how they felt about the way they'd gone through then the first 14 years of the 20th century as Oscar Wilde's children. And people have said to me, you know, thank heavens you did, because it would have been a terrible omission if we hadn't seen those letters. And they are terribly moving.
And Oscar in Paris is, as you'd imagine, deeply heartbroken, misses his children enormously. This is such an upsetting story about him seeing a little boy being scolded.
Oh, yes. When Vivian's first volume of autobiography came out in 1954, it was translated into French, and there was a Frenchman just outside Paris who read it and wrote to him and said, I used to see your father with my mother. I was about your age. We used to go to a restaurant in the Rue Jacob in Paris, And there was this very sad man who used to sit at the table near us. Anyway, to cut a long story short, he upset something on Oscar's table. His mother scolds him, and Oscar says, "Don't be unkind to your little boy. It's only an accident." And draws the little boy to him, puts his arms around him, and gives him a kiss on both cheeks. And then they see that he's crying. And then 56 years later, he writes to my father and says, "I wanted to tell you this, and I can deliver these two kisses. It's a long time in the delivery, but at least your father was thinking about you." I mean, I think that for my father made the... And there was some pain, the pain of writing that autobiographical volume, simply worthwhile to know that his father had been thinking about him so much at that stage.
Inconceivably sad. And one of the other aspects of your book is trying to untangle the truth, and you've written about it beautifully in the latest issue of The Oldie. You use an example, the story of Vivian and Cyril and Constance being kicked out of a hotel because of the scandal, which turned out not to be true. Is that right?
Well, it was... they'd booked themselves into... Constance had booked them into a Swiss hotel above the Lake of Geneva. But in those days, of course, the Côte d'Azur hadn't been made fashionable by Scott Fitzgerald. And so the crowned heads of Europe and posh people would go and summer in the mountains of Switzerland. So the hotels were booked up, you know, a year in advance. And they managed to get into a hotel in May. But by the time June came round, you know, all the bookings had been made a year before. And the hotel said to them, "We'll have to put you in the annex." And I discovered, with absolute proof, through a newspaper which recorded the comings and goings of all the foreigners, that they never left the hotel, but they were moved into the annex, which had just been converted from the Nestle family's summer residence into an annex for this hotel. But the fact that my father could still feel this sense of shame and of being rejected, sidelined, even by a hotel in Switzerland, was so strong when he was writing about it in 1954, that he interpreted it as being kicked out of the hotel. And the fact that they weren't, as I think I've said, is probably unimportant. The fact that he could still feel it after 58 years, which to me was so moving.
And one of the battles in untangling the truth is, in your terrific book, you also paint a considerable picture of your mother, who seems to be a formidable figure, and she still felt the scandal heavy on her shoulders. Is that right?
Well, I think that is absolutely right, and it's partly because she wanted Oscar on her terms, which was as the literary man, rather than trailing these clouds of scandal behind him everywhere he went. And I think that in the 1950s, anything to do with Oscar was picked up by the tabloid press, and it wasn't as a literary man, it was as this convict, homosexual and bankrupt, which he was by the time he came out of prison. And I think that for her, she was an Australian, she was brought up, she used to tell me, as a Methodist. So the whole idea of having a homosexual father-in-law, although she never knew him, I think was rather disturbing to her. So out came the whitewash brush. But it was also, in a sense, to protect me as a child from the sort of prurient interest of the press in everything which she felt was really unnecessary as far as the family and Oscar Wilde was concerned. I had a lot of sympathy for her, but I think she got stuck in a past era and didn't move on after the repeal of that act which sent her father-in-law to prison. I just regretted the fact that Oscar rather came between us.
And there's a moving scene when you're at Oxford and somebody asks you to write an article about Oscar. And what was your mother's reaction to that?
Well, he was an American who was about to start, I don't think he'd ever got off the ground, but he was about to start a little magazine, which wouldn't have had a huge circulation anyway. And he'd got, you know, people like Gore Vidal and very well-known names in American literature at the time to write for the first issue. And he wrote to me and said, would you write about Oscar Wilde and aestheticism? And I said, well, I don't know very little about it, but I'm studying French. What about Oscar and Baudelaire? Terrific, he said. So I wrote to my parents and said, guess what? And I got this letter back, signed by both of them, no less, saying, you will please not do it, because it could affect you, your future life into whatever profession you go in. Again, almost unthinkable in today's world. But and having been a bit of a stroppy adolescent, I thought I'd better knuckle under and not do it. And I never did.
You said in the ceremony about the British Library, the one question you would ask Oscar was, Why he sued Queensbury? Is that the big question?
I think it is. I mean, I think the answer people have probably got to by now. I mean, he's a playwright. He has two plays running in the West End of London. They're bringing in the equivalent, I suppose, of what in today's money would be somewhere between £7,500 and £10,000 a week in today's money. Box office receipts. He can do no wrong. He's the toast of London. Any jury is not going to find him guilty. Well, in fact, no, you see, I've made the mistake I always make. He sues the Marquess of Queensbury, but because Queensbury's barrister, Edward Carson, cross-examines him so fiercely and so effectively, I always feel, and I make this mistake constantly, that it's Oscar who's in the dock, when of course it isn't.
I think a lot of people do that, yes. Yeah.
But he just felt he was untouchable. And I mean, you've seen this in, well, no names mentioned, but in the last 20 years in England, libel cases where famous public figures sue a newspaper and finish up, if not in prison, certainly guilty and paying heavy costs themselves. I say, I would like to ask him, why did you do it? I think I know why he did it, but rather perversely, I'd like to hear it from his own lips.
And do you think otherwise that the famous illiterate calling card saying, posing as a sodomite, it would have just passed over? It wasn't particular scandal, is that right? The actual handing over of the card by Queensbury to Wilde?
Well, it was handed over, in strict legal terms, written on the card to the hall porter. So having not been, the hall porter put it in an envelope, so the hall porter could have seen what was written on the card, and therefore in legal terms it was published. Oscar doesn't get it until a couple of weeks later, and then appeals to young Robert Ross to come and see him at once. And Robbie, on the back of the card, I think, it's on the back of the letter Oscar sends asking him to come and discuss it. The ivory tower has been assailed by the foul thing. Very, very purple prose. And when Robbie gets there, Alfred Douglas is there. I've asked Bosie to come tomorrow, he says. But Alfred Douglas, went straight round and started working his magic even before Robbie Ross got there. Another of those great what-if moments. If Robbie had arrived and said to Oscar, tear the damn thing up, you're on a hiding to nothing. But Bosie was there working his magic, hated his father, wanted to see him behind bars. I was no longer the captain of my soul and did not know it. Ah, God.
And he, of course, appears a lot in your book, Bosie, but he's suing everybody left, right and centre, well into the 20th century, but I thought you were astonishingly magnanimous at the British Library event the other day. You said you thought he could have been a great poet.
Well, that's what my father said. And if you read Bosie Douglas's sonnets, they're very, very good. I mean, they are. I think his sonnets are much more, how should we say, modern for the time than Oscar's were. And he probably could. His prose style was good. His poetry was very good. He did edit a couple of very right-wing magazines in his time and got into terrible trouble, libeled Winston Churchill and got sent to prison for it. He was no slouch. He was an intelligent man, and I've always said he was a young, beautiful aristocrat who was also a poet. Oscar fell in love with him. Who am I to object? Who am I to start passing judgment?
But with an extreme streak of nastiness, it seems, running through Bosie, isn't there?
I think at the time he and Oscar were friends, lovers, I don't think there was too much in the way of what you call the nasty streak in him. And I think it's much later when people start accusing him of things, in some cases quite rightly, that he turns really quite vicious. But I haven't been overcritical of him. I think partly because people would have expected me to be. So, you know, he would say that, wouldn't he? So I've tried to avoid that at all costs. Simply present the facts and let people judge for themselves. There's a little tiny bit of me which makes me quite sorry for him.
It's another part of the tragedy, isn't it?
Yeah.
And the other question to finish on, the other great why, is why does Oscar see him again once he's out of prison?
Oh, God. well, again, it's conjecture, but I think very, very solidly founded conjecture on my part, that Constance definitely wanted to see Oscar when he came out of prison. Oscar definitely wanted to see Constance and the boys. And people, biographers always said, oh, well, she hesitated and she hesitated too long. And then Bosie came back into his life and that was that. Off they went to Naples for the winter together. But what I've since discovered is some correspondence showing that Constance really did want to go up to Dieppe and see Oscar, but that she listened to her family and her friends, all of whom advised her, no, give him time, let him find his feet, little period of probation, don't be hasty, my dear. And behind all that, I believe, was the terrible social quandary. If Mr. and Mrs. Wilde, and they weren't divorced, got back together, Constance is accepted into our society on the continent, what do we do about this criminal, this bankrupt and homosexual? Do we ostracize Constance? No, we can't. But do we have to accept him back into our society? Oh, God, no. So let's persuade Constance not to see him. And she listened. And that, I think, to me, that was the sort of slow-motion second tragedy. And Bosie worked his magic yet again, got his claws in. I've often said, I think if I'd been in Oscar's position, I probably would have done the same thing. I have to be loved and live in an atmosphere of love, as he said to Robbie when justifying going back to Bosie. How could I not love him? He's ruined my life. What a wonderful expression that was. I laugh every time I read it.
Well, that's a very funny, moving place to stop. Thank you so much to Merlin Holland, author of After Oscar, The Legacy of a Scandal, for talking to Radio Oldie.
Thank you, Harry.
You have been listening to Radio Oldie, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. Why not get 3 trial issues of the Oldie magazine for just £1? I'm sure you'll enjoy it. We'll then charge you £25.75 for every 6 issues. Just go to checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter old trial as one word in capitals. That's checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter old trial.